Not been around here for Lent before, we produce a daily reflection guide for that season, which this year will be on the cross. And this month, in the run-up to Lent, I'm posting a few reflections on our blog on the question, why did Jesus die? This actually was first inspired by parents who asked me, like, how do I talk to my kids about that? So posting a few reflections the couple weeks running up to Lent. You can check those out if you like on our website, and I look forward to sharing this really powerful season together in life of our community starting in just 2 weeks. Meanwhile, on this Sunday and next, we'll be wrapping up our winter series, Seven Stories. We've been exploring Jesus' story of liberation and reconciliation, and contrasting that to these other stories that we have been telling and listening to and following for far too long. We began our time a few weeks back with a children's book, Cory and the Seventh Story, that I read here. And there we met a badger and a fox, each of whom thought violence would be the means to a happily ever after. They told the stories of domination and revenge, the myths of redemptive violence, the very oldest human story, the founding story of America, I think, as well. And over the past 2 weeks, our pastors Ivy and Lydia talked so powerfully about two other stories that we tend to live into when we're threatened by how scary the world has become. So we isolate and withdraw with me and mine alone, or we lay blame for our problems or the world's problems on some set of people or behaviors that disgust us, thinking if we can only purify ourselves from those people or those things, we will have our happily ever after. And in many ways, I think those stories we heard about isolation and purification are the quintessentially toxic religious stories. They're how faith often goes bad. In our last 2 weeks, we're going to look at two more stories that I think are very much the stories of our times, the stories of accumulation and victimization. There was this moment in the story I read with the animals, you may remember, when the badger and the fox reunited with an idea to distract everyone from their many troubles and to enrich themselves in the bargain. They made a shiny object factory, which at first delighted all the families of their village, and it made them lots and lots of money. But in time, all the shiny objects didn't delight anyone at all anymore. They were distractions, they became ways to kind of measure people's status. And the making of these objects polluted the rivers and the air so that all these shiny objects didn't make for anyone's happily ever after at all. This story of accumulation and what Jesus has to say about it at first has some really obvious things to say to us, which I think even though they're obvious, are probably worth saying. So we'll start there. But we'll end somewhere, I hope, less obvious. Places thinking about how our addictions to accumulation is giving us more and more, or at least making us want more and more, even if we don't have it, but taking us off track from the really great that I think we want most. So I'll start with some words from Jesus along these lines. And from Luke 12, it says, "Then Jesus said to them, 'Watch out, guard yourself against all kinds of greed. After all, one's life isn't determined by one's possessions, even when someone is very wealthy.' Then he told them a parable. A certain rich man's land produced a bountiful crop. He said to himself, 'What will I do? I have no place to store my harvest.' Then he thought, 'Here's what I'll do. I'll tear down my barns and build bigger ones. That's where I'll store all my grains and goods. I'll say to myself, you have stored up plenty of goods, enough for several years. Take it easy. Eat, drink, and enjoy yourself.' But God said to him, 'Fool, tonight you will die. Now who will get the things you have prepared for yourself?' This is the way it will be for those who hoard things for themselves and aren't rich toward God." I love this story. It's grim, obviously, but I think it shows Jesus has a great sense of humor. And I think, man, is this story true? I think we know this. This is the obvious thing. Like, we have sayings in our culture, like, you can't take it with you. We have other phrases we've said, like, the one who dies with the most toys wins. But as a journalist pointed out, like, anyone who has ever said that must have thrown up a little bit in the back of their mouth, like, as they were saying it. So we just know it's not true. We know we can't take stuff with us. We know that more money and more stuff doesn't make us happier, often quite the reverse. We know that when we work too much, we end up hating our lives and living with regret. We know that when we make and buy and order and ship too much stuff, it just kind of fills up our closets and it fouls our earth and it supports crappy dead-end jobs for other people and it doesn't make us happy. Jesus' baseline point that more money and more stuff for ourselves will not make for anyone a happily ever after. It just seems so obvious, it hardly needs saying. And yet, though it's really obvious, we can't seem to change. It's far more true today than in the first century when Jesus told this story. We can't seem to find another way. Why is this? Why do we still write this story of accumulation? How is this story not at all just about money and things, but about so much more? And what's Jesus' better story that he's pitching? What might it mean, as he says, to be rich toward God? That's some of what I hope we'll be exploring today. When I was last in therapy, I was working with this approach called internal family systems. And one of the ideas of internal family systems is that each of us has lots of parts. We're like this family within ourselves, this system of selves. We may have this really fun-loving part of ourselves, and another part of us that really worries a lot, and another part of us that tends to get angry, maybe too much, and another part of us that tries to keep us organized, and so on. And all these parts are there for a reason. They have their good place. We've needed them to build our lives. Parts of us know to find food and to eat when we're hungry. And parts of us know to make or buy the things that we need. And parts of us know how to prepare for danger or accomplish goals or to present ourselves positively to the world. And all of that is just really great. It's so good to be a human being and to be so adaptive and to have all these parts of ourselves that build good lives for us. The problem is that most of us also have parts of ourselves we avoid. We have parts of ourselves that are very afraid. We have parts that are hidden or ashamed. We have parts that have suffered great pain. If we've experienced trauma in our lives or neglect or abuse, especially if that was so when we were young, then some of the sad or scared or angry parts of us may be very large and very deep. And this kind of approach to what it means to be a human and to therapy calls these parts of ourselves our exiles, the parts of ourselves we can't face with calmness and with curiosity and with compassion. And so when that's the case, we use these other parts to distract ourselves. And sometimes these parts get too loud and too active, and sometimes even out of control. So in my case, in therapy, we were noticing that much of my childhood, I was a pretty chill, happy-go-lucky guy. I was pretty confident. I was pretty peaceful. But then at one point, we could kind of mark the point that it happened. I became really internally driven. I became like sharply focused on anything I did, on killing it. Crazy high standards for myself. And there I was, after 30 years of that, wondering, how do I take my foot off that pedal? How do I slow down? How do I ease up? How do I kind of drive less and connect more? How do I do that? And in therapy, I started asking, what came into my life that made me so driven when I didn't start that way? And how did this drive that at one point was really positive that helped me build the life I want, how had that drive kind of overwhelmed the system? How had it become a distractor, something that now pulled me away from the life that I want? So I think for most of us, what Jesus is calling greed, hoarding up for ourselves, is not just about money or stuff. It certainly can be. One of the big innovations of 20th century American life was that marketers got really, really good at convincing us that we always need more and that we never have enough. The great majority of us in this room have way more money and stuff than our great-grandparents did. Not all of us, but the great majority of us. And yet, probably the great majority of us feel the need for more, even more than our great-grandparents did. we've kind of bought this system that's been put upon us, hook, line, and sinker. But we accumulate in lots of other ways, too. And when we do, I think it's not mainly like a character deficit to beat ourselves up about, as if that will accomplish anything. I think for most of us, accumulation is a way we avoid what's important. Accumulation is a distraction. Sometimes it's even an addiction that we pour time and money and attention into to kind of intentionally or unintentionally avoid what's most important. Because sometimes what's most important is hard. Facing what's most important sometimes maybe hurts. The other day I read this story from Jesus slowly while trying to be kind of meditative or prayerful about it. I was using this really great method of Bible reading and prayer that comes out of the Jesuit Catholic tradition. This method of Bible reading is to read the stories of the Bible. You can use it for other parts of the Bible that aren't stories, but it really works best in stories. To read the stories of the Bible, to especially read the stories of the life of Jesus and the four Gospels about him, and to read them imaginatively. This method is to imagine yourself in the story, to ask, like, what do you see? What do you hear? What do you smell? What do you feel? And how does it speak to you today? The Jesuits, like 500 years, didn't invent this method of Bible reading, but they popularized it. So I imagine Jesus telling me this farming story. And as I hear Jesus telling me about this person who builds his barns, I found myself immediately picturing the house that I grew up in, particularly the sheds on the back of that house that my dad had built and that were never quite finished. I remembered how growing up, our home was an unending construction site. My grandparents had bought my parents this little two-bedroom, one-bathroom house just before my older brother was born. And as our family grew, our house grew. My dad and my grandpa were both self-employed contractors, and they built together an addition to the house with an extra bedroom and a bathroom. And then my dad built a second garage and then expanded our family room and then built a shed and then another shed, and kind of on it went over the years. Partly there was a sense that, like, our family is growing, we need more space, more room. And partly it seemed to reflect like an ongoing restlessness in my family, that there was never quite enough all around. And this was like a tangible way to fight off that not enough feeling we all had in our lives. The thing was, as I pictured that setting for the story, I remembered that it was not glamorous. This accumulation of space, this constant building meant there were always tools and sawdust lying around. Things were never settled. They were always like in process. There was something always in progress, messy, unfinished. And I thought about that farmer, that builder in Jesus' story, and then to me, he seemed not just smug and wealthy and over-luxurious, which is how he probably comes off to most of us at first. He seemed kind of desperate. I mean, for a person in the agrarian and mostly very poor first century ancient Near East that Jesus lived in, to plant and grow crops was a really good way to manage life for yourself and for your family. But maybe I wonder if, in response to memories of hunger in your own life, which almost everyone in that region would have known, in response to maybe memories of desperate hunger in your family's past, you too feel like there will never be enough. We have to store up more and more. And so you start piling up so much food that you'll never need it all when plenty of other people do. And then all of a sudden, that's not so healthy. You can't face down that fear of never enough and ask if you can let that go. Like, what freedom that would be, to what freedom that would make to live well, to be truly rich if you could let that fear go, to be freed from it, rather than just keep piling up as a wall against it. You look for more and more until one day you die and you're still grasping, like still afraid of never having enough. I thought about myself then, and I thought, I certainly have issues around greed and fears around money and stuff, for sure. But this piling on, this building, this accumulating that came to mind for me wasn't that primarily, actually. It was other parts of me. I thought again about how driven I can be, about how when I complete a job and it's done, I immediately am like, what's next? I got turned right away. I thought about the never good enough way I can feel about my work and my effort, about my push to drive harder and do more, whether it comes to scheduling my week or accomplishing my goals, even to like hobbies in my life, think like how many books I read or how hard I work out or all kinds of places where I push and I push and I drive and I drive. And I was encouraged to remember and think, like, what am I avoiding? Like, what hunger? What not enough fears am I staving off with my penchant for more? And I thought of the feeling you can have in what seems like an incredibly productive world when you have ADHD, as I do. Thought of times when life seems out of control, when there's too much to do and I don't know how to tackle it. And I thought of how in this wonderful, wonderful city we live in, there are so many people, so many of you that seem so accomplished, so successful, so busy, so smart and so good at so many things. And I thought of all these times when I've wondered, like, how do I measure up here? Am I good enough to like, live in Boston? I need to be cast out somewhere. I thought back to all the times when I was younger and I was really afraid that my life would be a failure, that I would live the legacy of other men in my life, of not reaching my goals and being a disappointment to myself and just kind of a disappointment to my family and the people I love. And I went further back and I thought of the gnawing loneliness I had always had at times and wondering, like, is there room for me here? And it's weird because I thought of like the oldest stories of not enough in my life. I thought like pushing hard and being driven, it helps with some of these things, but with some of these things, it helps not at all. Right? But we're not fully logical in our hearts and our choices and how we manage all our parts. None of us are. But when I've reflected on my own never enough, my more habits, I thought, I don't think I need to wait until my deathbed to know that this is not my greatest life. This is not being rich toward myself, toward God, toward anyone else. This is not abundance. So what is? Well, Jesus tells his story that we call the story of the rich fool, which I call the story of the foolish me now too. Right, to be less judgy, I've decided we could call this the story about the fear of never enough. I think that's what it's really about. The story about the more accumulator in us all. And then Jesus immediately pivots and says this. I think this scripture will just be up on your slides if you want to follow along with me. Jesus said to his disciples, "Therefore I say to you, don't worry about your life, what you will eat, or about your body, what you will wear. There is more to life than food, and more to the body than clothing. Consider the ravens. They neither plant nor harvest. They have no silo or barn, yet God feeds them. You are worth so much more than birds. Who among you by worrying can add a single moment to your life? If you can't do such a small thing, why worry about the rest? Notice how the lilies grow. They don't wear themselves out with work, and they don't spin cloth. But I say to you that even Solomon, in all his splendor, wasn't dressed like one of these. If God dresses grass in the field so beautifully, even though it's alive today and tomorrow it's thrown into the furnace, how much more will God do for you, you people of weak faith? Don't chase after what you will eat and what you will drink. Stop worrying. All the nations of the world long for these things. Your Father knows that you need them. Instead, desire his kingdom, and these things will be given to you as well. Don't be afraid, little flock, because your Father delights in giving you the kingdom. Sell your possessions. Give to those in need. Make for yourselves wallets that don't wear out, a treasure in heaven that never runs out. No thief comes near there. No moth destroys. Where your treasure is, there your heart will be too. My early years of hearing and wrestling with this passage were almost absurdly rigid and literal and anxious. Like, is it bad to buy tomorrow's food today? Like, are supermarkets evil? Is it really bad to own a change of clothing? Are you allowed to save for retirement? Or is that somehow, like, sinful? Is Jesus saying you're a fool if you gain experience, or if you get educated, or make a budget, or plan a career? I don't know, but there are many signs that this is not the primary way to engage with Jesus' teaching. But the biggest sign for me is the anxiety of it all. Jesus is like fiercer and gentler than we tend to think. I think both, but gentler, right? That story of the never enough guy that I always call the story of the rich fool, right? Jesus immediately follows it by saying, like, I know you're so anxious. Here's a better way. This is a gentle story, even if it's also a fierce one. Jesus presenting a healing path away from our incessant anxiety, not like a more religious version of that anxiety. Stop worrying, he says. Don't be afraid, little flock. I don't think Jesus meant to introduce a new rigidity that says, literally, live like birds and flowers. Don't buy, don't plan, don't talk, just like let life happen to you. I think Jesus is actually saying something like, take your energy and give it to the greater, not the more. When it comes to our needs, Jesus insists the world has enough. There is enough. We can do our part in the process, but not more. More worry invites misery. More stuff invites moths and thieves and defensiveness. More work invites stress and regret. Accumulation always turns against us eventually. Jesus says, instead, give yourselves to what's greater. God is doing beautiful and important and marvelous renewal all around each of us. God's work on earth, Jesus calls it sometimes a kingdom. The beloved family God is growing. Some of us call it a kingdom. The beauty that God is creating and shaping. The opportunities to love and nourish and make things and people and systems whole. That which is greater. I'm using this word greater because it's really important in this Jesuit Catholic tradition that's been on my mind a lot lately. I mentioned earlier. It's a tradition I so much appreciate. The Jesuits use this word magis to describe the God who is always greater, as well as the possibility of doing things that are great for God in this world. And it's a funny motto, this Latin word magis, because it can be translated either more or great. So it could either be the motto of numbing, toxic accumulation, or the motto of the beautiful story of Jesus. So that's kind of a sort of fun and weird complexity. But Jesus says there's something different about the never enough life and the kingdom or the kingdom. One never has enough. The other believes there's more than enough. One can never work hard enough. The other knows how to work, but also how to rest. One thinks you have worked for everything you've got. We get what we deserve. And the other knows that so much of what's most important in life is received and welcomed as a gift. One is always piling up and holding on. The other takes joy in letting go and sharing and giving away. One looks back on a day. One looks back on a life with regret. And the other looks back on a day, looks back on a life with delight and joy. In my prayers in this passage, I found myself wondering with Jesus, what is the great that I miss when I strive for more? And I thought of a couple things that we'll end on here. I thought about our mission in life and about our capacity for rest. thought about how we conceive of our work, like paid or not, like what's ours to do in the world. You know, when it comes to what I think I have to do today, all I have to accomplish and get done, I almost always go to the more. My lists, like physical and mental for the day, are always too long. Now, some of that is just poor planning, like that's sort of comically so for me, part of the ADHD story. Like, here's what I think I will do today. It's like, have I not lived a day before? Like, that is not going to happen. Part of that, though, is like a symptom for just how I see my whole life. More, more, more. Like, more as a wall against scarcity. More as a way of feeling good enough. More as a wall against failure. More as a wall against facing the pain inside. But as I've shared, in my life, Jesus, as usual, tends to be right. It doesn't work. So what if I left behind more for great? I'm trying to start my day, or early in the day lately, asking Jesus to take care of my impulses to more and to trust Jesus that I don't need to do it all and that it is true that today's troubles are enough for today. And I'm trying to ask Jesus, what's the great for me today? What's the one thing or the small number of things, the thing for your family, God, the thing for your work on earth that is mine to give myself to today? In asking that question, I find I calm down and my focus does shift. My focus narrows in some ways from the so many things to one or two big things. But my focus widens in other ways, from worrying only about a kind of in a desperate way, like my own personal good, to embracing the common good. I get more generous toward others. And sometimes I even get more generous to myself. One of you was recently sharing with me how you start the day with your spouse doing something similar, like asking Jesus, like, Jesus, what do you have for me? What do you have for us today? And she was surprised that for a while what would come to mind would be things like, how about you fill your freezer up with vegetables? You know, you're going to want to eat vegetables, right? So, like, go get the vegetables. And she'd be like, really? Like, that's the big thing on God's mind today? Like, go buy vegetables. She'd be like, all right, thank you, God, for reminding me to take care of myself. Like, off to the vegetables. Or the same thing, or something would happen, like she'd feel permission to take that run she wanted to take and thought she didn't have time for. And like, enjoy that run. And she'd think, all right, well, thank you, Jesus. Off I'll go. I know the gift of the kingdom, the gift of this kingdom, isn't only about self-care. It doesn't end with just like more veggies and more exercise. I thought of my friend's story. I'm trying to listen for myself. Like, sometimes for some of us, it starts there, maybe. Anyway, this great instead of the more. God's good gifts and good ways for us to be part of the common good. That's where I'm going more and more and more. I hope that's where we're going. I want to invite you to think for a minute about where you want to go. We've got a couple minutes for this. They'll be on your slides. I think they're in your program as well. But this week, we normally have two areas of thinking, like, what would this talk mean for me? And so we try to think about very intentionally, like, what does this mean for me in terms of the common good? We usually call those like a tip or a practice for whole life flourishing. Like, how do I live my whole life well for the common good? And then also, like, what's a spiritual practice for me, a way to move forward with God into this life God has for me? I sort of combine them this week, spiritual practice for whole life flourishing, to ask these questions, these four questions. And you can ask them just today. I'm going to invite you to ask them now if you like, or if these seem helpful to you, you could try them out each day this week and see where they guide you, where they lead you, and if that's not good news for you. Well, let's take a moment. If you don't mind, just kind of take a look at your program or the slides. If you want to just let me walk you through it and close your eyes, that's fine too. But we'll see what these questions evoke for us today. We'll pray into that, and then we'll move on to our service. But the first question to ask is just ask, what is my not enough? What is my more accumulation? Where is the sort of lie, compulsion, distraction, addiction of like, there needs to be more? Where's that live in me? The second question is to ask, like right now, do I have habits? Do I have deep habits of rest? Am I taking care of myself? Do I have habits of letting go? I'm not holding on to problems and stress. Do I have habits of giving? Does my life have the generosity I would want in it? The third question is to ask, what am I afraid of facing? What am I afraid of losing? And the last question is to ask Jesus, what is the great instead of the more for me today? Jesus, we'll just take another minute and see if there's anything you want to draw to mind for any of us. Jesus, as we ask these questions, we ask that you'd be good news to us this day, this week, that you'd bring into us more and more the good news of the great things you have for us, that you'd be to us good news of letting go, good news of taking care, good news of generous living, good news of the common good. Good news of a full and joyful, focused life. Amen. Well, thanks for sharing time together. Thank you, Matt. I'm going to invite you to stand in a minute and let